This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 28 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I feel like I haven't talked to you guys in ages. I was busy over the 4th of July weekend with some friends in town, and I hope everyone enjoyed their 4ths as much as I did. But we're back to the grind, and fantasy football season is starting to heat up. So let's dig into these mailbag questions. The first one is from Twitter, at Adrian_Charlie. He says, am I alone in fading round 4 to 5 running backs? Feels like round 1 to 3 are juicy, but can't get hyped on guys in the 4 to 5 range. So the 4th round on fantasyfootballcalculator.com consists of Ty Montgomery, Carlos Hyde, and Spencer Ware. And then the 5th round includes Doug Martin, Adrian Peterson, CJ Anderson, and Amir Abdullah. That's roughly the same according to fantasyadhd.com's MFL 10 best ball data, but there are fewer running backs being drafted in that area by degenerates who have been drafting in those drafts since March. In order for those players to be fade-worthy, you'd like to see guys going after them who are fairly interchangeable from a projection standpoint, and guys with similar floor and ceilings. And I think you're right, Adrian. I think there are players going in the 6th and 7th round who feel just as safe and have the same risk profile as those players do in the 4th and the 5th. For instance, if you want a floor, Frank Gore is a decent enough RB2 who you can get in the middle rounds. If you want a ceiling, you can look at Mike Gillisley, whom I love, because he could easily outscore any of those players that I mentioned, given that he's in that New England offense. Eddie Lacy, another guy who has tons of upside given the offense that he's in, and the quarterback who's under center for the Seahawks. Honestly, looking at my projections and analyzing this situation, Ty Montgomery is the only 4th and 5th round running back that I really dig when balancing floor and ceiling. At a higher level, though, something to keep in mind is that this isn't totally abnormal. I wish I could show you the chart, but this is a podcast and you only get to hear my sweet, sweet voice. But if you chart average draft position by fantasy points scored, so what players did at season's end versus where they were drafted, the trend line shows some sort of leveling out around pick 50 over the last half decade. What this means is that as you move down one pick to the next, you're gaining less of an edge points-wise at the position after that pick. So while I agree with you and think that your observation is correct, I think this is an occurrence that we should almost feel every single season. Snake drafts are not linear, meaning one pick to the next pick to the next pick doesn't decrease by the same expected point value. Once you hit rounds 4 and 5, the difference in players from there to round 6 and 7 isn't all that significant. And I think that's exaggerated at running back because the NFL has moved to so many committee systems. This next question is an email from Matthew Rice. I shortened it a bit for podcast purposes. He says, hey JJ, just started listening to the podcast this week and I'm a believer in the zero running back strategy. Here's what I'm struggling with. I was wondering if you could explain the value of tight ends in a PPR league. Using the zero RB strategy in a mock draft, I landed Gronk with my 3rd pick in a 12-person draft and thought that wasn't terrible. Should I value him the same as a top-tier wide receiver, or does the volatility of the position lessen his value and increase my chances of a wide receiver with higher upside? Matt. The beautiful part about analyzing flex spots in fantasy football is that you can actually look at the number of points scored across positions rather than just within positions. But don't think the supply and demand aspect of the game doesn't matter as a result of this. For instance, let's just pretend in a hypothetical world, we'll call this world Jeff Fisher land, that fantasy team defense could be played at the flex spot. And let's pretend that defenses generally score more points, not significantly more, but more, than running backs, wide receivers, and tight ends. That doesn't mean you should heavily prioritize team defense. Like the podcast on adjusting to league settings taught you, or hopefully taught you, I won't go as far to say that everything I say is so easy to consume or makes total sense, but what that episode hopefully taught you is that you should look at roster requirements first and foremost in your league to get an idea of the supply and demand of that league. So if you're starting just one team defense and you can play that team defense in the flex, but if you're starting, say, 4 running backs and 6 wide receivers, despite that defense being significantly better in the flex, the demand of the other positions in your starting lineup should still dictate a wideout and or a running back heavy approach in your draft. So back to your question, the inherent value of tight ends is less compared to wide receivers and running backs because most leagues start just one tight end. That means more will be available on the waiver wire and more usable ones will be available later in drafts. That makes a player like Rob Gronkowski less valuable because you can get, say, Kyle Rudolph in round 9 or 10 and still feel pretty decent about the position. If you can flex the tight end position, they do become more valuable as you're able to play them in more spots in your lineup. The problem is that tight ends as a whole don't score a ton of points compared to running backs and wide receivers. Last year was a down year for tight ends, but Travis Kelce, the top tight end, ranked 28th in scoring among running backs and wide receivers and tight ends. Gronk, the year prior, was 15th. Basically, it'd be hard to justify placing him then with the elite wide receivers, because even if he finishes, say, 10th in total scoring, non-quarterback scoring, that is, this season, you're ignoring the opportunity cost in that you're not getting a wideout or a running back with that early pick, getting Gronk instead. And there's a positional scarcity issue in doing that. So his overall ranking, despite being 10th overall in points scored, should be lowered a bit because of that positional scarcity. By how much is the question? And that, to me, is dependent upon how you feel about your first pick or your second pick and the way your draft is projected to go. I don't mind him in the third round, though. I think that's strong value for a player that can still give you a significant edge this season. This next one is from Twitter, @ShockerManner. Last year, around week 10 to 11, you discussed Flacco as a positive regression candidate in the touchdown rate department. Is he still for 2017? So I did discuss this last season because Flacco was on pace to break yardage versus touchdown records last season, but in the wrong way. Basically, he had way too many passing yards for the number of touchdowns that he had thrown. And even at the end of the season, Flacco averaged almost 216 yards per touchdown pass, which was a bottom five number among relevant quarterbacks. And he had a 3.0% touchdown rate when his career rate is 3.8%. So yes, I do think he's a positive regression candidate. The problem with Flacco in single quarterback leagues is that he's never shown much of a ceiling in the past. Last year was the first time he threw for over 4,000 yards in a season, and his highest touchdown total in a season was 27, which was done in 2014. When you can get so many good quarterbacks late, it seems odd to focus on Joe Flacco in a regular fantasy football format. Best ball, I can understand, but in leagues where you can adjust and play by matchup and go for ceiling, Flacco does not fit the bill. With that being said, I think he's a great second quarterback in two quarterback leagues. In 2015, he had 5 top 12 performances in 10 games played, which is actually really strong at the position. That year, he played Denver in week 1 and was just smoked, but after that game, he had 4 top 8 performances and, as I said, 5 top 12 ones. Granted, the Ravens threw the ball a lot that year, and they've led the league in pass attempts over the last two seasons. I expect that number to drop for reasons I've discussed on this podcast before, so if that volume dips, he'll need slightly better efficiency. I think he can, given the positive regression coming, but that also is a reason to not love him as your late round quarterback this season. This next question is an email from Joel Schlosser. This group assembled for a league I'm in is relatively inexperienced in fantasy football and the drafting process. Some will more than likely auto draft. Should my strategy change going into a draft with such unknown? I like to go zero RB and grab a late round quarterback. Thanks in advance. To be honest, with more inexperienced players or owners who aren't going to care about their teams, you can just take more chances. That means you can go with an earlier round quarterback approach and easily correct the opportunity cost involved in doing so because fewer teams will be playing the waiver wire and so on. Essentially, anything that you can't usually easily correct, you can in drafts like these. I wouldn't change my approach up dramatically, but you can be a little bit more of a risk taker in this type of scenario. This next one is an email from Samir Ahmad. Hi JJ, this is my first time writing to you. I'm really enjoying listening to your podcast. Love the short, to the point format as it makes it easy to digest. Thanks Samir, I really appreciate that. I had a question about making the most out of the flex position. I understand that in a PPR format, you probably want to aim for a top wide receiver or pass-catching running back in the draft that you can plug in the flex, but what's your strategy in standard drafts? I play in a league that starts 1 quarterback, 3 wide receivers, 2 running backs, 1 tight end, and 1 flex, where you can plug in either a tight end, wide receiver, or running back in that flex. Do you recommend targeting 3 running backs early so you can plug one in the flex spot? Or do you just go with the best players available and then worry about the flex later? Would love to get your insight. Thanks and keep up the great work with the podcast and Number Fire. Samir. So we've got another flex question, but it's definitely different than the first, so let's dig into this. A lot of my analysis is done from a PPR perspective. So I normally just mention that wideouts should be used in the flex when talking about the flex. The reason for that is because, well, they score more points. Over the last 3 years, if you combine wide receiver and running back scoring, so this has nothing to do with tight ends because of what I talked about earlier, the top 50 running backs and wide receivers over the last three seasons in PPR leagues consisted of 34 wide receivers and 16 running backs. The top 40 had a 27-13 split. The top 30 was 19-11, and so on. Wide receivers in PPR leagues rule the flex. Switch things over to standard, and literally the opposite happens. The top 50 is a 28-22 split in favor of running backs. The top 40 is a 21-19 split. And over the last 3 years, 9 of the top 10 scoring seasons in standard leagues have come from running backs. So to answer your question super directly, yes, you should assume a running back is going to be in that flex spot. As a result, you should have a running back heavy approach. They'll not only be more predictable in standard formats, but they'll just generally score more points for you in that flex spot. The next one is from Twitter at Michael Dubner. He says, for hashtag SFB7, do you expect to go zero wide receiver? So for those of you who don't know about Scott Fishbowl, it's a massive league of fans and analysts run by Scott Fish each year. This year, there are 720 teams, giving us 60 leagues that then will play later in the season in a playoff. The scoring changes each year to make it fun and more competitive. This year, we've got a starting lineup of one quarterback, two running backs, three wide receivers, one tight end, three flex spots, and one super flex spot. So it's pretty insane. Scoring in the league is pretty normal, aside from the fact that quarterbacks get 6 points per touchdown pass, which I talked about before. I don't care about that. And then players get a first down for rushing and receiving. But on top of this, tight ends get 2.5 points per first down. It makes tight ends a lot more valuable. And running backs are going to be pretty beastly too, given the first down in non-PPR scoring. So this is actually a good example of the type of scoring and rules that should alter the way you think about a league. You are starting 3 wide receivers, but you can also start 5 running backs or even 4 tight ends if you wanted to. But this type of draft definitely should dictate a running back heavy approach. And I would guess that I'd be going 0 wide receiver when the draft starts in a couple of days as a result of that. This next one's from Twitter as well, at SKIan1997. What are your thoughts on Paul Perkins, his ADP, and the Giants' backfield in general? You know, when I read this question, I realized that I haven't dug into the Giants' backfield situation enough this offseason. I mean, I have projections for each player and whatnot, and Paul Perkins comes out as a decent enough low-end RB2 / high-end RB3, but I don't think I've done enough thinking around the true ceiling of the guys in this offense. So thank you, Ian, for this question. You've got Paul Perkins, Shane Vereen, and now Wayne Gallman in that backfield. And Orleans Darkwa, of course, who sounds more like a cartoon superhero than an actual person. But Gallman is a below average prospect in my prospect model, and Paul Perkins is slightly above average. Perkins didn't have the best measurables in the world, but his college production was definitely above average overall. Perkins did get a little run last year as a rookie, and according to NumberFire's metrics, he was the most efficient Giants running back in per rush efficiency as well as success rate. That's not saying much considering the competition in New York, but that's got to count for something considering he was a rookie. I do think that Perkins gets a decent market share chunk this year on the ground, somewhere in the 48-55% range, which can lead to 200 or so carries in that offense. That's totally fine, and to me, that makes him worthy enough at his ADP in the 6th or 7th round. I think he's one of those players that I talked about at the top of the show that you can feel decent enough about after foregoing a running back in round 4 or round 5. However, and this is important, it's tough to get excited about a Giants running back from a true ceiling perspective. Shane Vereen should demand a lot of volume through the air. They added Brandon Marshall to limit the receiving market share even more, and Evan Ingram is there now too. The offensive line, on top of this, is not very great. And there's always a chance that they change up the goal line back considering Perkins' smaller frame. That could be Wayne Gallman. That could be his role. So overall, I think Perkins is probably a decent value in fantasy drafts right now, but he's not someone I'm going to tout like crazy as a screaming bargain because there are certainly scenarios where his floor becomes a little bit more scary. He could become a guy that you feel confident in going into each given week and then he doesn't give you enough. Like, I could see his situation being Amir Abdullah-like, where he's not the primary goal line guy, and he's not the primary pass catcher. He's just sort of in the middle, and that's not where fantasy points are scored. And if he's healthy, you're going to keep trotting him out in your lineup, and like I said, he's not going to give you that ceiling week to week. But I do like him enough, and I think that he's a good running back for zero RBers to grab. This next one is an email from Ross Kidwell. In keeper or dynasty leagues, many times owners trade future picks for players in order to win a championship. When it comes to the draft, then, you don't have a full complement of picks. How does that affect your draft strategy? Are you more or less likely to draft floor or ceiling type players? Do you embrace variability in the draft? Would your strategy change if you had traded earlier picks or traded later picks? Thanks, Ross. This is going to be a super lame answer, but it all depends on your roster construction. But generally speaking, I think that you should approach the draft in a pretty similar way. You're getting dudes you like based on analysis that you've done. You can think of it this way too. Our evaluation of prospects is far from correct. It's actually pretty bad because it's such a tough thing to perfect. So as a result, players who you think are safe aren't safe, and players who you think are volatile aren't volatile. It's how football goes. I think changing your strategy heavily as a result of having more or fewer picks assumes that you know a lot more than you actually do. You can change up the types of positions you're drafting, that's fine, but I wouldn't think too much into the type of players that you're getting unless it's something like a player who's never healthy or a guy who has serious off-the-field issues. This next one's from Twitter, at Craig Evers. He says, thoughts on Jordan Howard would be my flex in a 12-team, 7-keeper, non-PPR league, thinking of trying to trade for a wide receiver starter like Sammy Watkins. Thanks. First off, I definitely would not trade him for Sammy in a non-PPR league. Not only could Howard end up being a top-notch running back for years to come, but this is non-PPR. I just went over why that's vital for running backs. Regarding Howard himself, it's not that I'm in love with the guy, but the Bears' offensive line is actually pretty good, and Howard produced like an animal last year. Regression can hit a bit, I get that, but this is not a Todd Gurley situation where Gurley's efficiency was super high his rookie year, and his success rate was low, meaning he was fortunate to be gaining his efficiency off of big plays. When charting rushing net expected points per rush, which is NumberFire's metric of efficiency, versus success rate, or the percentage of positive runs made by a running back, Jordan Howard last year was actually perfectly in line with the trend line of backs over the last half decade. His success rate was strong, as was his efficiency, meaning he was just playing at a high level. He was a really good running back last year. He doesn't have much competition too, which is nice, so even if he slips a bit, you'd imagine he'll still be on the field. The downside for Howard is obviously the offense that he plays in. When you're at that point in the draft, you'll probably feel more confident drafting players in similar roles but in better offenses in general, like Jay Ajayi or Melvin Gordon. With that being said, Howard's production profile last season trumped both Ajayi and Gordon according to the NumberFire metrics that I work with running backs. So again, don't trade Howard for Sammy Watkins. And how I feel about Howard, well, I've got him as an RB1 again this year projections-wise, but he is below Gordon and Ajayi given the offense that he plays in. I'm worried about that touchdown upside, which is even more important in standard leagues. He's still in a good spot this year, though. This next one's from Robert Young, an email. He says, hi, JJ. Thanks for your insight on whether or not to draft handcuff running backs. I was recently listening to your broadcast on handcuffing running backs, and I thought it was very enlightening. Thanks, man. I learned a lot, and you really opened my eyes to a lot of things I wasn't aware of. It makes so much sense now that I think of it. Thanks again. My question is regarding something else. I don't know the context of the specific topic, but you talked about drafting a wide receiver with a really consistent weekly scoring rate, a wide receiver that you can pretty much count on for a regular score each week. Then you said you combine that with a player like DeSean Jackson or a wide receiver who could blow up for a high score in a week, but could also give you 0, 1, 2, 3 points in other weeks. Was I correct? If so, would that be for standard, PPR, or keeper leagues? Additionally, if that's correct, my next question would be this. Is that something that you always use as a strategy? Because I find that I would rather have players that score a consistent weekly amount rather than having wide receivers that are all over the board. I don't like players scoring 1 or 2 points per week for 2 to 3 weeks and then go off for 30 the next. You can't count on them, and I just get really frustrated with the roller coaster ride. What do you think? And then he signed it. He said, call me Why the Frown, but my real name is Robert. Well, Why the Frown? Yes, this is correct. I'll admit, back in the day, I was overly concerned with consistency in fantasy football. I wanted players who gave me the most top 12 or top 24 weeks without thinking about what that really meant. The way I've approached fantasy over the last 3 to 4 years, though, is less about finding that floor and predictability and more about mixing floor and ceiling for any league type. And the reason is because intuitively, a team without ceiling players may never yield a high enough weekly score to get you victories, while a team with only ceiling players is naturally far too volatile. With that being said, I think it's important that we don't overstate what this means. Players like Jarvis Landry and Golden Tate and Julian Edelman will certainly be bucketed as floor wide receivers, but they still are capable of big enough weeks. It's more that their standard deviation is less than players who are more touchdown dependent, like a Dez Bryant. You can look at the coefficient of variation to help you out with this. You take the standard deviation of a player's weekly output and divide it by that player's average or mean. The closer that number then is to zero, the more predictable and stable his performances are. The top notable players who aren't necessarily elite in that statistic over the last few years are guys like Demaryius Thomas, Julian Edelman, and actually Mike Wallace. Jarvis Landry and Golden Tate are up there as well, which is no surprise. On the other side, AJ Green pops up a lot, as does Sammy Watkins and Dez Bryant. This shouldn't be shocking though. They're deep threats who can put together monster games because they score all these touchdowns. So it's those players that I want to pair with the former group to have a great balance of ceiling and floor each and every week. The next one is an email from Rolando Martinez. How do you feel about stingy listeners who don't want to share your awesome pod to other league mates? LOL, thanks. I'm flattered by this question, but I wanted to include it in here because if you don't want to share my podcast and help a brother out, you can still help by leaving a review on iTunes. They really, really go a long way in helping get this podcast out there. So if you've liked what I've been dishing out, and that includes the air horns, please, please, please go leave a review. I'd greatly appreciate it, to the point that if we ever met IRL, I'd give you not just a high five, but a bro hug too. This last question is from Brian Witten. He says, hey JJ, I'm a 33-year-old dad who loves eating cereal, and I'm not talking about the mulch mix type garbage. What are your top three cereals? Mine are Cinnamon Toast Crunch, because it's always consistent, good for breakfast or a snack. Rice Krispies, RK Treats, always solid. Again, good for breakfast or a snack with spoonfuls of sugar, of course. And then lastly, s'mores. Can literally eat an entire box in one sitting if you aren't careful. This is a once-in-a-while treat, or I'll embrace full dad by having one of those hard dad bellies. Keep up the podcast, brother. Brian. I'll admit, I'm kind of into the mulch mix type garbage. I eat a bowl of cereal with almond milk each morning to get me going. If I ate Cinnamon Toast Crunch, I'd undoubtedly be way heavier than I am now. With that being said, Cinnamon Toast Crunch is the true goat. The after eating milk is one of the most delicious things man has ever created. And here's a hot take for you. I don't mind Fruity Pebbles, and I don't mind soggy Fruity Pebbles. That milk is super underrated too. That'll do it for this week's questions though, guys. Thanks again for tuning in. As always, you can subscribe to the show by searching for the Late Round Podcast pretty much anywhere podcasts are found. And like I said, please leave a review on iTunes. I'd greatly appreciate the love. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you all early next week.